Well, I'd like to begin by repeating something that I've said many times before, and that is the fastest way to get from A to B is to be completely at A. So at least that's part of the kind of little slogan for this practice that we do, the insight practice, that there is a place to go to, there is a direction, there's a journey to take. And the primary way that I prefer seeing that journey is the journey to the freedom from suffering, to the diminishing of suffering, to the end of suffering. And it is possible to take that journey. It is possible to come to the end of suffering. But to get to that end, it works best to be really where you're at, here and now. And this journey of the seven purifications is a journey that ends with the end of suffering. And the stages, seven stages, could be seen as kind of a hierarchy of stages, progressive and to go along. And for many of us, that's a setup for thinking we should be a different place than where we're at, that we should be further along, or and then we maybe compare ourselves that maybe other people are further along on these very funny named stages. Some of them are mouthful. Not so easy to go to parties and brag about. Purification through knowledge and vision of what is and is not the path. Probably people's eyes will glaze over or feel sorry for you. But still, there's this hierarchy, and you know. And but it's very important that to respect each step we're along the way, where we are. We're at different places at different times. And sometimes we cycle through in some kind of one way, or we jump around, or who knows. But the task is to not rush through a particular stage, but to really be anchored or rooted in the stage you're in and really do it well. So the first stage of purification of virtue, it's a noble and worthwhile endeavor to establish our integrity and to put effort into that and really kind of embody that, live that in all the ways that it takes. Not an easy thing to do, it's a noble thing to do, to find our way to do that work. And to really kind of stand in that stage, stand in that activity, is inspiring to see. People are owning up to where they're at and working on it. And the, you know, the second one, purification of mind, the emptying of ourselves or putting aside of these powerful forces in the mind of greed and ill will and sloth and torpor and restlessness and remorse, doubt, the hindrances. I mean, we don't want to underestimate how strong these operate in us, and that to be at the place where that you're, this is what you're going to, what you're up against, and you're standing, you're rooted in an upright, dignified way, that now this is the work that I'm doing. And no need to rush ahead. It's like doing the work of each stage is what allows for everything to unfold. And so developing a stability of mind, a steadiness of mind that comes with meditation practice, concentration practice, or even mindfulness does it, to create a stability, steadiness. A mind that's comfortable with itself. And a mind that's comfortable with itself can rest, can settle. If the mind is uncomfortable with itself, it'll be jumping around and reaching out and pulling away. And to kind of come to some degree of being comfortable in your mind, your heart, and yourself, so you can sit there and be present in a relaxed and open way, is an important task. And that can take a long time to do that, and it's a very, very, very worthwhile thing to do. And then the purification of you, to kind of begin being so interested in our experience that we're willing to put a question mark next to a lot of the concepts, ideas we have about reality, about philosophy, about religion, about Buddhism, that we tend to use as filters through which we see our experience. And put that aside and in order to really kind of be here. And this idea of being here, really here, so we can really see the particularity of the experience of now. Not the generalizations of it, not the views of it, but actually to kind of see the direct experience of the sense experience, the arising and passing of phenomena. And when we put aside these all these general concepts or big concepts we have, some of them which maybe have served us well in getting through life, but you know, not to dismiss some of them, but there's something very special about being able to take off those glasses and then to see directly for ourselves what is actually here before the concepts, before the ideas, before the conclusions, before how we generalize about what is here. And for some people, it's not an easy thing to come to that. There's a lot of doubt about the value of doing that, because it's kind of going back to the building blocks of direct experience, hearing, seeing, touching, smelling, tasting, and seeing the mind. And it's such a kind of basic level that it might even feel like an insult to our sophistication. You know, we're smart and have wonderfully important things to do in the world, and big ideas and plans, and to kind of settle down and just be in the simplicity of this moment. You know, why? Why would we do that? Well, the next stage is the stage of purification of doubt. Kind of beginning seeing why we do this, the value of it. And one of the things that we begin seeing when we kind of be really close to the experience, we start seeing what the tradition calls conditionality, how things occur based on conditions. Some people might say because of causes. And, you know, it's not a few of us that are mystified why we do certain things. Why do we react certain ways? Why do we have certain impulses that go on? And so to some degree, as we start getting down into the kind of the basic experience of how things are arising and passing, some of this is no longer so mysterious. And we can start seeing some of the conditions, underlying conditions, that sometimes has fueled sometimes dysfunctional behavior in our lives. And a fairly common one that many people see, especially on these retreats, is they start seeing the underlying pervasive role of fear in their lives. That, you know, they've been so busy thinking big thoughts and concerns about planning and remembering and all, that they're not really paying attention to the immediacy of their experience so well. And then it turns out if you really relax all the concepts and ideas, there can be a pervasive layer of anxiety. And you see that as a condition, and that anxiety is seen as the condition that seems to trigger thoughts, views, understandings, reactions, behaviors that, you know, we never quite understood why we did it. I remember there was a woman who came on retreat many years ago who was had songs going through her mind when she meditated on retreat, and she'd been going on for years. And she talked to many teachers to get advice, and she was a very diligent practitioner. So she followed all the advice. None of it worked. And I was one of those who gave her great advice, but it didn't work. So finally I asked her to look and notice when it starts. When did the singing in her head start? So she had nothing else to lose, I guess, at this point. So she started looking at that, and the course of the retreat was looking. And what she discovered, that the singing, music, always began in what she called transitions. If she was at the end of the sitting, if she was going to go up to the walking, or when she was going to leave her room, or go to a meal, anytime she was going to go into some kind of thing new, the music started, and she realized that she was comforting herself, that these transitions were a source of some kind of anxiety for her. I mean, probably an old habit, but a little bit the uncertainty of it, that she used this to comfort herself. And when she saw that, she no longer had to have the music to comfort her. So, you know, so you start seeing the conditions that underlay. And so sometimes there's a lot of insight that can happen at this level. Oh, that's why I feel that way, or do that way, or have those thoughts. And now I understand it. There's X and there's Y. Oh, that's how it is. And, you know, so you might have a knee pain, and because of the, you know, but you notice every time you have a knee pain that you break out into hot sweats. You're just kind of like, just really anxious. And then after a while, you get quiet and still enough, you find out that you're, oh yeah, when I was a teenager, I tore my knee. And that was such a traumatic experience for me, it never really got resolved. And so any kind of knee pain, I actually am touching this deep, deep wellspring of kind of fear and distress and that I had from that injury that I had. And so then you can kind of, these kind of early kind of conditionings can sometimes be resolved or finished. But to really be there and see, oh, look, there it is. And so sometimes this leads to a lot of thinking. We have these great insights and understanding. But we start seeing, there's not any doubt or mysterious why we do certain things that before were quite mysterious. And but the way we got there was becoming quieter and stiller, and to really see, you know, right under the surface, letting the usual discursive mind get quiet and start seeing below the level of concepts. As we do this, we see that the simplicity of experience. So we see the tradition talks about seeing what's called nama rupa, mind and matter. We start seeing the physical aspects of experience, and we see the mental aspects of experience. As I talked about yesterday, things arise and things pass, and whereas a thought about the weather, you might be so caught up in the weather and the thoughts about it and the idea of the weather that you don't really notice that the changing nature of the weather in the moment, that the wind is shifting directions and the clouds are shifting and coming and humidities are changing, and it's not the weather is not a thing, it's a flow, a changing pattern of phenomena. But if you only, if you think the weather, we're kind of not really, we can lose track of the changing flow. It's possible. I mean, maybe it's not the best example, but I think I get the idea. But if we can see, if we see, we have thoughts about the weather, and we see the thought of the weather is fleeting. The thought of your friend is fleeting. You have a judgment about someone, and you could be fixed in that judgment. That's the way the person is. But if you see the nature of that very thought, it arises, passes, and is renewed. We tell a story, we keep renewing it. And the keep renewing of the story gives a semblance that your friend is always the same way, because you're constantly thinking that one way. But if you can see that the thought is just something that arises in the moment and then passes, you have a very different relationship to that thought. Then you see the thought for what it is, inconstant and permanent, as opposed to not really recognizing what the thought is and seeing the world through the filter of that thought. So we get back down to this kind of baseline of just a direct experience. And the tendency is to begin seeing a thought as it arises and thought as it passes. And the arising and passing, the appearance and disappearance of a thought, becomes more interesting than what the thought is. And the thought doesn't have so much power over us because it's just a thought, just something that comes and goes. Same thing with emotions. If we can get locked into the emotions, concerned about it, have all kinds of conclusions about it, which is certainly relevant sometimes in life, but the opportunity of sitting quietly and still, we see that actually the emotion itself is made up of something that arises and passes. And it gets renewed, maybe by keep telling ourselves the story that triggered it or something. But then after a while, it becomes more interesting to notice that the emotion arises and passes than what the emotion is itself. We still might see what it is, but it's after a while it becomes how things change, the flow of change, that becomes interesting. And so as we settle down, and there's less distractions, less hindrances that keep us away from the present moment, and we enter into this world of things that arise and pass and change, it's possible to get concentrated on that, absorbed in it. And it can feel very, very interesting, very engaging. Some of the concentration factors that are known with concentration practice come into play. There can be feelings of joy and happiness and equanimity. Some of the jhanic factors can get quite strong, even just not focusing on one thing, but focusing on the stream, the flow of things arising and passing. And there's a lot of stability, steadiness, that allows us to see all that change. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we cultivate samadhi, is we have the steadiness so we can see what changes. One analogy is if you're maybe walking through a pedestrian congested city, metropolitan area, lots of people are walking and you're walking and they're and you have experience, you realize there's lots of people, but you're walking along with them, finding your way, negotiating and everything. That's one experience. But if you, in the busiest sidewalk, if you just stop and stand still, and maybe if you're short, you get up on a soapbox, and just stand still, then you become much more aware of how much movement there is, coming and going and flowing and moving. That's more acute than if you're actually going with it. Or if you're, you know, floating on a raft down a river, it might be nice. But then if you throw an anchor into the river and you don't move anymore, then you see how much force there is against the boat. You start seeing, oh, the river's actually moving a lot. Or an analogy, an example I love is, I don't know if you've done this. If you haven't, you should do this. I did it when I was a kid, is go to take your car to a car wash and stay inside the car as it goes through the car wash. And now, if you went through the car wash in a convertible with a convertible down, you'll have one kind of experience. And you're probably kind of like so overwhelmed and so troubled and so, you know, afraid of what's happening, and, you know, it's just like just chaos. You can't really make sense of it. But if you have, you know, it's a, you know, hard top where the windows are up and closed, and it's completely dry inside, and safe and cozy, and all this water gets, and brushes swirl and do their thing. I mean, it's kind of like fun. It's kind of like, wow, look at all that stuff, you know, all this change and stuff. So it's kind of, if you have the stability as you meditate, just really rooted and really here in a strong, steady way, then you kind of have this bubble or something where the flow and the change of the present moment, as it gets more and more clearly seen, it's okay. See it come and go and arise and pass. And the tradition puts a lot of value on this insight into seeing the rising and passing of phenomena, because the understanding is this is its true nature. This is the nature of our experiences. They're fleeting, they're changing, they're moving, they're arising and disappearing. And so it isn't so much we don't have to work to do this, it's more like we're just relaxing and seeing and knowing more and more deeply. And you know, one of the ways to get to this is what we talked about this morning, is if you see that a particular knowing of something arises with that something, and when that something goes away, the direct knowing of it also goes away. And then you start seeing how fleeting it is, both experience and also the knowing of it. And the knowing sometimes can give the sense to us that there is some permanent consciousness, pervasive field of consciousness that's here, that can be very satisfying and very meaningful in some ways to feel that. But sometimes it's kind of like a little bit of the same kind of illusion as that of a movie on a screen. We see continuous movement on the screen, but I think we all know that there's no movement on the screen. It's a series of still shots that are shot rapidly on the screen, and our mind reconstructs it or kind of processes it, creating a movement, almost like it fills in the gaps to kind of look like there's movement. There's no movement on the screen. But we think there's continuous movement. So when there's a whole series of very rapid knowing, moments of knowing, just one after the other, that are probably happening faster than, frames per second in movies, it can give the sense of a continuity of knowing that has no gap. And so it can feel like a continuous thing. But sometimes it's possible for some people, not everyone has this, but there's strong enough, still enough concentration to see that there's moments of knowing that arise and they pass, arise and they pass. So this can be, so at some point, as we go through these stages of purification, and this is the route of vipassana really takes off when a person sees the arising and passing of phenomena. And sometimes that's the very definition of formal vipassana practice, is seeing in the direct experience how things arise and pass. And it certainly has value, that kind of insight. And there's a lot of other purposes for mindfulness practice and mindfulness meditation. Many people find tremendous value in other ways. But the classic way is that the mindfulness becomes strong enough that we're settled, relaxed, peaceful, concentrated, and we kind of open up to how these things, everything kind of arising and passing. Sometimes it seems like everything in our field of experience is arising and passing, flowing and going. And because there's no hindrances operating, the mind can get concentrated, and it feels very good, very focused, very engaging. And it can feel a little bit like onward leading, like, oh, this is good. This is like, there's a lot of confidence. There's a lot of feeling, this is right. I'm connected to the truth. There's also less and less experience, or less and less seeing in the experience of self in the experience. There's a sound, and there's a thought. That's a dog barking. That just arose. And there's not, you can't really take credit for it. This is, I did it. Just a sound. Just a sound. The sound is not you. But even the thought doesn't make sense to make this thing that arose without your intention and agency, the self. It's just what happens. And this idea of no longer using, seeing things through the reference of self is something that happens at a particular stage of practice. It doesn't negate the value of seeing things through the filter of self at other times. But as we go deeper, we start just, the experience we have, the sensations, the thoughts, the perceptions, the mental formations, the intentions that arise, we start seeing it seems to be this flow of conditions that flow one to the other and they rise. And all this stuff, there's no self in this experience. We also start seeing that everything is changing, it's impermanent. And also we start seeing that as things change and flow and move and there's no self in those experiences, that is also unsatisfactory, it's actually kind of dangerous to cling to them, to hold on to it. So, this is not, so then we start having what's insight into what the tradition calls the three characteristics. It's not belief in that things are impermanent. It's not involved a belief that there is no self. But rather it's a seeing that there's no self to be found in the experience we're having. There's no permanence to be found in the experience we're having. And if we can enter that world, it kind of begins showing us a very different way of being alive. It shows us a way, at least temporarily, to be alive without this duality, the split, the hardening of self, of me, myself, and mine. Some people would say that this is a kind of a unitary experience or a non-dual experience sometimes, where there's no self in the picture, no self and other, no self and who's having an experience. There's no, subject and object to it, in terms of a self. And I believe that coming to this kind of stage is one of the pulls of spiritual life, to come towards a place where we transcend the usual structure or duality of self and selfing. So, transpersonal experience in a sense. A sense of, some people would call it unitary. Some people hold it up as being kind of ultimate to do this. But it's very satisfying to kind of have an experience without this usual idea of self operating in the middle of it. As the concentration deepens and as the inspiration and the faith arises around this experience and sense of rightness, it's like now you're really connected to something that's more connected and real than the concepts and ideas that we've been living with, there can arise what's called, I like to call them the 10 impediments to mindfulness, 10 impediments to the path. And oddly enough, some of these are the kinds of experiences people have been craving for years, or holding up as being proof that they're spiritual, or they're getting there. And so these impediments are, if I can remember the list right, luminosity, experience of light, illumination, knowledge, clear knowing, like such clear knowing, like now you really know. Rapture, ecstasy, deep tranquility or calmness, happiness, faith, kind of effortless effort around the mindfulness, strong kind of effort, where the mindfulness just kind of flows effortlessly. I mean, finally, I'm arrived. And then there is assurance, a deep sense of confidence and assurance. And then there's a certain kind of clinging that, or a certain kind of delight, joy, that's considered to be a kind of clinging. I don't quite understand how this works, but that's the way it's usually described. And on the last one, I think the 10th, is equanimity. And some people hold equanimity as being the ultimate. It just feels, man, that sometimes... So these all are impediments, are problems to have. You wish you had these problems. And the reason they're problems is that some people mistake them for enlightenment, or they're so satisfying that people cling to them and hold on to them. And one of the ones that's most commonly, I don't know most commonly, but often associated with enlightenment is equanimity, because it's so satisfying, so freeing, so absence of suffering in that state. Jack Kornfield tells a story of, he has this book called The Path with Heart, and I think it was that one, or it was another one, more recent one maybe. So it was only some years ago. He went to Burma and he brought a copy, the English copy, with him. And he was told about, there was this very highly realized psychic monk, old man, who didn't speak any English, but he went to see him, and he handed him the book. And the man put his hand on the book and just felt it for a while. And then he said in Burmese, something like, "This book teaches equanimity, only equanimity." So, I think he was implying that Nibbana is not taught in this book. It's pretty good, equanimity, but, And so there's... So that was kind of interesting, that for Jack. And these 10 impediments. And it's at this point, at this stage that I'm talking about now, it's the fifth stage, is the knowledge and vision. So there's kind of a direct knowing and direct seeing of something. The knowledge and vision of what is and is not the path to liberation. And so we know that the path to liberation is to see, continue to see the direct experience of things arising and passing, the immediacy of the impermanent nature of reality. The path is not found in settling for rapture or joy or equanimity or strong knowledge and clarity. Effortless mindfulness just flows along almost without any effort at all. That there's no experience that is the experience, there's something you can actually experience and feel, which is the end of the path, that's liberation. And I think this is a very important thing to realize, because many people think that there's an experience they're going to have that's going to be so sublime, so exquisite. It's about having this experience that's somehow the point of all this. And these experiences of these 10 impediments are very satisfying, very sublime, wonderful to have. But rather, the path is coming to the end of clinging. To no longer cling to anything, no cling to any experience we have. No longer have any clinging in the middle of the flow of arising and passing of things. The path is found by releasing the holding, the fixating, the reifying, the resisting, the opening of the hand, opening the fist of the mind. And so the path is found by continuing to be mindful. You need to stay present for the experience as it unfolds. So there's no stopping. So we don't stop anywhere and rest. This is it. As soon as we stopped, it's not the path. As soon as we get involved in generalizations, as soon as we get involved in particular experiences of being it, we've kind of lost the path, kind of taken a detour, a side trip. And so the idea is to stay there in this very simple experience, settled, clear, present, of things arising and passing, seeing the arising and passing of stuff as the selfless nature of it. And then kind of getting closer to it, present for it. It's said that this state of knowing the really clearly establishing that this is a path and not the path culminates when the seeing the arising and passing of phenomena is so well established and strong that there's an onward leading quality to doing the practice. It's almost like that you put a ball on top of a hill, or a snowball on top of the hill, it rolls down the hill, and the snowball gets bigger and bigger as it rolls down. So at some point, when the seeing arising and passing is so strong, that it just kind of begins having its own momentum, and we enter into this flow, and it's a kind of clear, stronger concentration, more present, more intimate with the experience, and the sense of intimacy and immediacy. And it's quite fascinating to be in this experience because the usual concepts we use for what our experience is has receded far away. So, you might have all kinds of sensations in your body coming and going, but you're not operating on any concepts of there being a body. It's just, tingling and pulsing and pressure and all these things coming and going. There might be a sound, but there's not operating anymore the concept of a car. It's just a roar going by. And there's kind of this quieting of the mind. So it's kind of entering into kind of a different dimension, different way of being. And so you see being present for the rising and passing. As with any concentration practice, it's not something that comes easily, and it's not something that you should be straining to experience or feel like if you don't have it, somehow something is wrong with you. What's really right for you, what's right when you're right, is when you're standing where you're supposed to be. Standing, being present for your life as it is, this moment, and whatever it is that you need to be present for and see and look at is what you give yourself over to. So if we follow this idea of the stages of purification, if what needs to be looked at is the issues of virtue and integrity, that's the perfect place to be. If what it is the purification of mind, looking at the hindrances, that's the perfect place to be. To be where you're at is the recipe for allowing yourself to settle, to be present in a non-conflictive way, to not be troubled by things, but to actually work with them and understand they're workable. And it's a way of learning this very important skill of simply being present with what is. And the further you go along on this path of vipassana, the more and more useful it is to have learned the skill of just being present with what is. And we learn it wherever we're at. So you don't have to go looking for something different or a different experience. But be present and interested in this moment's experience. Your lived life only occurs now. And to allow yourself to kind of be in your lived life, to live your life as it is for you now, that's the right place. The fastest way to go from A to B is to be fully at A. And that when what A is changes from sitting to sitting, day to day. And so you sit down, every time you sit down, every time you go walk, you're there to discover, what is it now? What is it now that's the lived experience to be present for here now? And whatever it is, it's the right place for you. Thank you.